Welcome to A Public Affair on KGNU. I'm your host, Alexis Kenyon. Today, I'm speaking with Mo Clark, a Colorado-based reporter whose most recent story for ProPublica investigates how Colorado's halfway houses are a revolving door to prisons. Mo, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
To start off, tell us about Colorado's halfway house system. What is it? What was the intention when it was created? And what drew you to report on it?
Sure. The system's been around for a long time. It was established in 1974. It used to be under the jurisdiction of the prison system and kind of got pulled out, and it's now under the Department of Public Safety. And there's been a huge constriction in the number of facilities over the last couple of years. When I started this project, I think there was 33, and there's 26 now. When they were established, one was to reduce prison overcrowding, and also it was seen as more of a rehabilitation. And that sounds great on paper. I think what we found through the investigation was that's not really happening in practice, maybe in certain programs and certain facilities. But overall, yeah, kind of was a hindrance to people. There was all these added barriers that make it really, really hard to get through the program.
Yeah. So you start your article with the story of a man whose experience is a great example of what you're talking about. So Andrew was in prison for 12 years and facing what turns out to be a pretty difficult decision for him when the court tells him he can finish up his time served at a halfway house. Tell me about that decision.
Sure. Andrew's decision is very common. And a lot of folks feel like it's too big of a risk to finish out their sentence at a halfway house because so many people get sent back. I heard that from every single person that I talked to that ended up in a halfway house from prison. There's a lot of rumors that go around. They hear in prison that the case management isn't good. The rules are arbitrary or too harsh. Like, I heard from a lot of people that they're just dirty and prison was nicer. And generally, there's sort of this sentiment, if you just wait one more year, it's just easier to go on parole. You can move in with your family. Yeah, I heard that really early on. And I was just like, wow, there's a lot to unpack there.
So Andrew ends up going to a halfway house, despite warning. What happens then?
So he spent 12 years in prison. He committed a crime as a juvenile, and he was sentenced as an adult, went through a lot of programs, support groups. He got his electrician's pre-certificate before you can get your full one. So, he was really, really excited to start a career, and he was really excited to see his long-term partner, wife, finally be with the person he wanted to be with and start a family, and then was nearing his parole date, so applied to the halfway house. He told me he already had contacts for electrician jobs. He got an electrician job. They said it paid too much and that he would be overwhelmed with how much he would be paid, and it wasn't in the right location. And so he got a job in a warehouse.
Okay, so it's en route to the warehouse job. Kind of after putting his dreams on hold, he ends up getting sent back to prison for what the halfway house called a technical violation. What happened?
So when he was at the halfway house, he used the gas station restroom three times while waiting for the bus. And so he got sent back on a technical violation, and he did another almost year in prison. And he said that was by far out of the total 13 years he spent in prison, he said that year was the hardest.
So there are a lot of alarming statistics in your story. One of them, you found that about a quarter of people get sent back to prison for this type of technical violation in the halfway house system. What is a technical violation? What does that mean?
Yeah, 25% of people will get sent back for a technical violation. And that's actually the statistic that got me the most interested, because I wanted to know I didn't even know what a technical violation was. And I wanted to know what constituted a technical violation, who decides what's a technical violation. And what we found is there's no standardization of what a technical violation is. And the state oversight agency, Office of Community Corrections, doesn't collect detailed data on what a technical violation is for. Yeah, the state told me directly, these things aren't standardized and it's left up to the facilities.
So what are some examples of rules that you found that could be technical violations in halfway houses? I mean, because I think everybody understands some rules, but...
Sure. I mean, yeah, like you said, there has to be some rules, and everyone agrees with that. But, like, one group of facilities, it says in their client manual that they can't wear tank tops, or having a candle is a serious violation. Before they leave for the day, they have like a very, very strict schedule that has to be approved by facility staff, including when they leave and when they arrive. And they have to call as soon as they get to a new location. And so like even a couple minutes late is a serious violation. And if someone gets to work and forgets to call, if they don't call within an hour, that is considered an escape. And so escape is sort of the highest level of violation you can get. And they could get sent right back to prison or prison for the first time.
Yeah, those seem pretty excessive.
Yeah. I think the most jarring rule for me is there's a rule that I saw in a couple client manuals that said not following a direct order from staff is a violation. And so I heard an example, a man came downstairs to get his breakfast. And the staff member said before he could get food, he had to vacuum, mop, and clean the entry hallway. And he said, no, I need breakfast so I can go to my job. And they said, you don't get breakfast until you clean the facility. And that would be considered not following a direct order from staff. And so it just gives a ton of discretion to staff members to really determine what's a rule and what's not.
Okay, so... one thing that you mentioned early on in your article was that people can be sent back for threat or for being suicidal.
Yeah. So there. Yeah, that was actually in Boulder.
Really?
So the person did not get sent back. The state actually stepped in that instance and said, you can't punish someone for that. The person got written up the highest level of violation for threats of violence, but it was threats of violence towards himself, and he was asking for help and he wasn't well, and the state did step in that instance and was like, you can't do that,
just send someone back. And another guy you interviewed, I want you to tell us about, he was actually able to graduate from the halfway house system, but his story is also a crazy example of how inflexible these rules can be, even for people who are fully committed to following them. Tell us this story.
Yeah. So his name's John Sherman, 66. He had been in prison for 34 years. Yeah, had never been written up in prison ever, like was very much a rule follower. He told me a story that the warden called him in to his office to tell him that he also got his sentence commuted by the governor. Again, super, super rare. And he was so excited. He said that it was like alligator tears. Like he was just like crying in the warden's office. The warden filmed it. Yeah. So very excited to get to the halfway house. Day two out of prison, he was at a halfway house in Denver. He got approved to go buy clothes at Walmart because he was still wearing his prison stuff. And he had a hard time navigating public transportation. He didn't have a cell phone. And he got to Walmart. And when he walked through the sliding doors, there was like 18 family members there to surprise him because they weren't allowed to visit the halfway house yet. And he said everyone was like giving gifts and hugging him and crying and like stuffing money into his hands. And a couple minutes went by. He said everything was like sort of moving slowly. And he said all he could focus on was all of the colors. He was just like fixated on the colorful clothes. And his sister, like, frantically reminded him that he needed to call the facility because every time they arrive somewhere new, they have to call the facility. Since he didn't have a cell phone and he's not allowed to borrow other people's cell phones, it has to be a landline. He went to the customer service desk and asked if he could use their phone, and they said no. And he said he ran around the Walmart trying to find a payphone, and then he didn't have money to pay for the payphone. A family member gave him money and he called, but he was a few minutes late. He said it was like less than 10 minutes. And he said he didn't sleep for days. He was like so distraught that he had gotten a write-up because he had never gotten a write-up. And then in the next couple of weeks, he got seven more of just losing track of time and forgetting to call. And I heard from a lot of people that that obligation is really hard to abide by. We're not used to like checking in every location you change. Even if you like stop for gas on your way to going somewhere with someone, you're supposed to call the facility.
So in your reporting, you found that the number of people actually running away from halfway houses has increased almost 200% in the last 10 years. I mean, are things getting worse in Colorado's halfway house system, or what did you find?
I don't know. Again, that data point is really opaque. And I think there's a lot of interest from lawmakers to better understand that statistic. I spoke to a handful of people who were overwhelmed and they just ran away. I think I would love to see an evaluation on how facilities have expanded and their level of services. Some of these facilities have more than 300 people in them and very small number of staff members. If someone's in crisis or is having a family emergency, like they are going to run. They're going to, from the Jefferson County government employee, she told me a story of someone, her daughter was raped and was in the hospital, and she went to the hospital and they arrested her at the hospital for escaping. Like things like that, I think we don't understand that data point enough to understand, yeah, the extent of that. But yeah, the escapes have gone up a lot. There's some facilities that have like almost 40% of their population run away, which like on all angles, we don't want that for public safety. I don't think I want to know why, what they're running from, if they're experiencing harm within the facility. Some people do run and commit a new crime. It's a really complicated question. And I've asked that question to halfway house providers, and the response has been the same every time. It's that everyone struggles with that, and the facilities aren't locked. It's an open campus setting, and escaping, quote unquote, is just walking out the front door. And so they've sort of been a little dismissive to that question because they don't have access to those people after they escape. And it's sort of like, yep, escapes are just a part of the system. And if that statistic was what we had for prisons, like I think people would be paying attention to that more.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to A Public Affair on KGNU. I'm your host, Alexis Kenyon. My guest today is journalist Mo Clark. We're discussing her most recent investigation for ProPublica, documenting the pipeline between halfway houses and Colorado state prisons. So, Mo, to give listeners a bit of background about your reporting, can you tell them what beats you've covered and what outlets you've worked for prior to working for ProPublica?
Sure. My beats historically have been housing and homelessness, criminal justice, and environmental issues. And I worked during the pandemic for the Colorado Sun. I was based at the Capitol. I was a politics reporter. I then moved over to Colorado Newsline, also in Denver, and I covered housing and homelessness and criminal justice, which is kind of where this story came from, my reporting while I was at Colorado Newsline.
Yeah, actually, I wanted to ask you about that. How did you start looking at this?
Sure. So I had just heard over and over and over again how bad Colorado's recidivism rate was. And even if it wasn't related to what I was talking about, I always asked my sources, like, why are we so bad? And I just never got an answer. Like, I just never really felt like I understood why we were so bad in that category. And there's been improvements. There's some really cool, like, new programs in prison, helping people re-enter after prison. There's some amazing organizations that are helping folks. But I just wanted to better understand why we're so bad. And this was actually my last story at Colorado Newsline. I was taking a teaching gig at CU, and I went to an art gallery that was showcasing incarcerated artists. So artists all across Colorado's prison system submitted work. It was incredible. And a director of a nonprofit that I had already written about related to Colorado's recidivism, it's called the Second Chance Center. The executive director, Hassan Latif, introduced me to a guy, and they had this like big, beautiful reunion. It was so obvious that they hadn't seen each other in a really long time. And the guy had gotten out of prison 2 days earlier. And I was just telling Hassan that I really wanted to learn more about the halfway house system, and I was hoping to find someone that I could follow through the process. And he kind of joked and was like, well, the perfect person's walking right up to us. And that's when they had their reunion. And I like very excitedly asked this man if I could follow him around. He had been in prison, I think, 26 years, and I might have to check on that number. Yeah. And he had had his sentence commuted by the governor, which is a huge deal. That doesn't happen a lot. And you could just tell this man, like, I don't know, he had a presence, and I was just like, can I document this process for you? And he said yes. And that's kind of how it started. And I started reporting. I actually submitted a pitch to ProPublica while I was still at Newsline to do their local reporting network program. And I didn't get it. And then I kind of, in classic journalistic form, just started reporting the story without knowing that I was going to be paid for it. And then resubmitted a pitch in like November of last year. And they liked it. And yeah, here we are.
Here we are.
So really just a prison art show
yeah,
was how this kind of started.
So one thing that you investigate in your story is how the system, which is taxpayer funded, also collects rent and fees. So taxpayers pay around $80 million a year to fund this halfway house system, but average rent per person is about $500 a bed. I mean, who's in charge of making sure that things aren't being corrupted in this system?
Yeah, there's not a lot of oversight of those state funds, partially because so much of the system is privatized and it's allocated from the general fund by lawmakers, goes to the local government, then it's subcontracted to these companies. So it's sort of kind of this web of funding. So they get this year they got $86.7 million for this fiscal year. And then yeah, like they collect rent. This year, it's actually paused because they got a big bump in their reimbursement rate. So they're getting more money from the state in exchange for not charging rent. And so that's sort of an experiment, and we'll kind of see what that leads to. But historically, they in 2020, they collected $15 million from residents in rent. That is just for rent. They also pay treatment costs. They have to pay out of pocket for like any assessments that they have to do in order to get treatment. The facility has power of attorney of all residents' finances. And so if they need to buy work boots or they need to pay for child support, like they have to go to the facility, request a money order, and that's how they pay for things. Kind of the other half of that coin is if people escape and are reincarcerated or just escape, the facility legally can keep their money. And so there's no requirements for them to report what they do with that money. And so the money is supposed to go towards court fees or restitution, child support, fees that they owe. But yeah, there's not a lot of tracking of that.
Another point of this investigation that you found was a lot of these decisions that these halfway houses made were like, if not explicitly tied to who was paying rent and paying their fees, but if you looked at correlative information, you could see like the people who are getting disciplined and sent back were those who weren't paying the company. And also these halfway houses found reasons to, you know, expect somebody to pay something and then knowing that they wouldn't be able to do it so they could send them back.
Yeah. So the facilities would definitely disagree with that. And what we found was there were things in audits and through interviews with staff members that alluded to that happening. And
will you tell me the story about the bathrooms?
Yes. So a facility in Lakewood owned by Intervention Inc. They're one of the biggest halfway house providers in the state. This story came from county employee. She's the director of justice services. And in her role, she directly oversaw two halfway houses in Jefferson County. She told a story. Someone had like vandalized a bathroom and they couldn't figure out who did it. And so they put everyone on what's called a facility hold. So I've heard from a lot of people that people have lost jobs through these facility holds. And it's supposed to be used if like someone is a danger to the broader public, that they get put on a hold until like the police come and pick them up. Yes, someone vandalized a bathroom. They put everyone on a facility hold. They couldn't figure it out and ended up taking the money from all of the residents to pay for the repairs. The facility didn't respond to questions I had about this instance, but the county employee said that she got involved and told them that they can't do that and made sure that everyone got their money back. But she had told me, like, that was just the one instance she found out about. Yeah.
So there is some recent progress, or what some consider to be progress, from the state when it comes to fixing the halfway house system. One is they are planning on incentivizing halfway houses with more money for programs that have better graduation rates. They also, as you mentioned earlier, are offering about 20% more money to companies that do not charge rent. At the same time, the state has decided to reword the definition of recidivism in a way that actually makes halfway houses seem like they're doing much better than the current definition affords. And a lot of people say, actually, the standards need to be going up for halfway houses in Colorado. Tell me about the reaction to this.
Yeah, what they're doing is called performance-based contracting, which a lot of other systems use. Essentially, your state funding is connected to your performance. We've never had that. This is sort of a big deal for the system. They've been talking about it for decades. In a 2004 state audit, the state auditors were like, you should really do this. And 2022, it's happening. So yeah, if they meet these certain benchmarks, they qualify for more money per bed. The folks that I talked to did say that it seems like they were sort of lowering the bar and making this sort of like benchmark more attainable. And this is on top of them already getting more money per bed this year in exchange for not charging rent.
So they have more incentive to keep people in the program.
Right. Yeah. I think only evaluating those two kind of is still a pretty incomplete picture, and experts definitely agreed with that. Yeah.
It seems like, so before, the incentives were kind of the opposite. That you were almost incentivized to have people not graduate, or, you know, have people return because you would get more money for that. And this at least is a step.
Yeah. The experts I talked to said it was a step. The important, I think the key part of this is, like, if someone was okay with the amount of funding they were getting, they're getting more funding than they ever did this year, even without charging rent. If they were fine with that and didn't care about those incentive metrics, they could just not do it. And so one thing that I'm looking at closely is if they're actually being pushed to improve their outcomes, or if people are just like, well, we're happy with the amount of funding that we have, so they don't have to participate in that performance-based contracting. So there's the incentive side, but there's not really the punishment side. And the state has had this authority to pull contracts or decrease funding. They've had that authority for decades, and there's only been a few instances that they've used it.
So is there anything else you want to add that I didn't ask about?
I think my takeaway, I kind of like joked with my friends, like, reading the story to me as a journalist, I'm like, this shouldn't have taken me 9 months. Like, the information that we got over the last 9 months really should have been out there. Not really groundbreaking things. And that's sort of been my takeaway. This system hasn't had a close look in a while.
Yeah.
And it sort of made me sad to read the story, and just knowing that it is so, so clearly just scratching the surface, and that it took 9 months to just verify pretty basic things, like where our taxpayer money is going, which we still really weren't able to answer.
Mo Clark is a Colorado-based reporter whose most recent story for ProPublica investigates how Colorado's halfway house system is a revolving door to prison. Mo, thank you so much for talking with me.
Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to A Public Affair on KGNU. I'm Alexis Kenyon.